Hello and welcome to Radio SGN. I am one of your humble hosts, A.V. Eichenbaum. Pronouns, they, them. And with me, as per usual, is Lindsay Anderson. Lindsay, it has been quite a week. I feel like I keep saying that in these recordings, but it has been. How are you holding up?
I'm holding up, I guess. I don't even know. My birthday was this week.
Yeah, so, happy birthday.
Yeah, that was fun. I don't know. I'm trying to not think about all of the awful things going on, balance it with some good. How about you?
Yeah, well, I was a little bit sick the last couple of days. Started feeling it around Wednesday, and then, you know, it got really bad Thursday. But I'm feeling okay as we're recording, which is nice. It's hard to do everything I do with a fever. I'm feeling good, though. You know, got a lot of rest, and I'm just tired in general, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know if that's emotional or physical or if it's just stress or age. I'm moving is part of it. Work is crazy, and the world outside of me is unforgiving and cruel. So what are you going to do, right?
Yeah, definitely. It feels like nothing stops, nothing slows down. If you did want to do a quick pop culture corner check-in, your sentiment reminds me of this show I just binge-watched on Netflix, Beef. Don't know if you've heard of it. If you haven't, I recommend,
no.
But it'll kind of probably make you depressed. It's very up your alley. It's very philosophical. Every episode is named after a quote from a philosopher. It like dives into nihilism. There's like a bunch of chaotic artwork. It's crazy. It's gay. It's insane. Love it. It's great. It's from A24. You got to check it out.
I'll check it out. Speaking of numbers and terrible things, SB 254. Florida's GOP Senate bill, we didn't get to talk about it in the news because it just passed after we went to print, but Florida did end up passing a gender-affirming care ban that could potentially remove trans kids from their parents. I didn't do a lot of research on this. I don't feel confident speaking on it, but that is what's been on my feed all morning. A nice thing, I guess, a positive thing, is Maryland passed a bill protecting gender-affirming care and access for trans people on Medicaid. So that's cool, too. Way to go, Maryland. Fuck you, Florida. Let's talk about other things.
Okay, let's see. Well, we could talk about something kind of good going on in the news in Washington, which is our cover story, Books Unbanned. It's a new program from the Seattle Public Library that is making books available for readers between the age of 13 to 26. And anywhere in the country, you don't have to be in Seattle. You can sign up for a digital library card through the Seattle Public Library and have access to all of their ebook materials. So this is providing access to, theoretically, readers in Florida and in other conservative states where they're experiencing a lot of book bans to be able to still read books that are important and gender affirming and queer affirming. And it's just really important.
Yeah, Seattle Public Library is really killing it these days. I'll be honest. Like, they got rid of their late fees recently.
Mm-hmm.
They archive us on microfiche, which is cool. The SGN, if you ever want to go pick up an old copy of the SGN, you can find most of them on microfiche at the Seattle Public Libraries and in their system, and that's really cool.
Yeah, they also have a really cool program for people that are able to get into the library in person that maybe would benefit from Books Unbanned as well. If you want to access specific books about trans people or BIPOC people, books that have been banned and challenged in a lot of places that maybe your parents wouldn't let you read if you're in a non-affirming household, they will let students, people, anybody check these books out without a library card, which is great. One of the books that I've seen available is Melissa, which is one of the most banned books in the country. It's for middle grade readers, and it's about a trans girl. And yeah, any student, anybody can just go in, grab the book, and leave, and you don't even have to check out or anything.
And that's for ages how old to 26?
Well, Books Unbanned is for 13 to 26, but this in-person program where you can just take one of these specially marked books is for anybody, any age. Just, you know, come on into the library. They just ask that you return it when you're done reading, but on good faith, they hope that you will. And I think that's pretty cool.
Amazing. And folks out there, you can use your laptop, your tablet, your phone, even your Amazon Kindle, which I have one still. Amazon just recently made it so that you can upload PDFs and non-Amazon publications to your Kindle. So do that. Go get those books. Read. Educate yourselves. It's one of those few joys in life, and it's one of the few things that actually does help you later on. Just get more information into that brain of yours, folks.
Yeah. Well, and just also to hammer in how important the Books Unbanned how kind of revolutionary it is. Seattle Public Library is only the second public library system in the United States to implement this. The first was Brooklyn Public Libraries. So hopefully we'll see this happening in other places in the country. But Seattle, go us, go Washington. Washington really is kind of leading this fight against a lot of the homophobic bans and legislation that we're seeing in the rest of the country.
Yeah, absolutely wild. Never thought I'd see the day as a Californian, but here we are. Well, folks, Mia McCullough is our guest today. You'll learn all about her in just a bit, and we've got some ads coming to you. All that and more after the break.
History begins somewhere, and in Seattle, LGBTQ plus history began in Pioneer Square. As early as the 1930s, LGBTQ plus folks started coming to this neighborhood to form community, make friends, meet lovers, care for those who were sick, and fight for their rights. On Square One from History Link, hear stories from people who live this history firsthand and those who want to keep this history alive.
Square One is available wherever you find your podcasts.
Hi, this is Dr. V. Hill with V. Hill Family Medicine. Ever wish your doctor knew you by name, understood where you were coming from, and listened to your unique health concerns and worries? I have built just such a practice where the focus is on you and the care delivered is in line with your values and ideals. Learn more about affirming primary care at VHill Family Medicine. Visit VIGILMD.com or call 253-693-0071.
Radio SGN is brought to you by Poquitos, an LGBTQ-owned and operated business located in the heart of Capitol Hill, proudly celebrating their 12th Pride Festival in the Pike Pine Corridor. Presenting delicious Mexican cuisine prepared with ingredients of outstanding local sourcing, Poquitos hosts Mezcal Mondays and Tequila Tuesdays, featuring half off on premium tequilas and mezcals. Now open for lunch and weekend brunch with open-air dining and an outdoor, pet-friendly patio. More info and reservations at vivapoquitos.com. That's VIVAPOQUITOS.com.
Now part of the Seattle Gay News Podcast Network, Being Yourself Loudly illuminates the beautiful and chaotic path of becoming the best version of yourself, even if your brain is a bit chemically imbalanced. Whether you're seeking affirmation that there is more to life than just work, or you're looking for insight on how to live a more intentional life, I am your host, Isabel Mata, and I am here to serve up exactly what you need to hear. Your mental health doesn't define you. It's how you work with it, not against it, that does. Being Yourself Loudly is free to listen to and available wherever you stream your podcasts.
Joining me today via Zoom is an award-winning playwright, a filmmaker, someone whose work just made their Pacific Northwest premiere. Her name is Mia McCullough, and she wrote The Squirrel Plays, which you can see at Mirrored Stage right now, if you would like. You go on there and get those tickets online. There will be links in the show notes. Mia, how are you today?
I'm a little exhausted. I just got back from Seattle yesterday. So.
I'm so sorry. There were some nice sunny days last week, but today is miserable.
Is it?
Oh, yeah. Yesterday as well. So how did you enjoy Seattle? Was this your first time visiting or?
No, this is, I don't know, my fourth. I was here at the beginning of rehearsals as well. So I was there about 5 weeks ago for the first 3 days of rehearsal. And then I came back for like tech dress rehearsal previews opening. And I have been there a couple of times before. I really love Seattle. My legs are not accustomed to the hills. I live in Chicago, where it's completely flat and I'm never challenged by hills. So, my legs are like, what is this thing that we're doing? This is uncomfortable. But no, I really love it.
I'm a transplant myself, so there is an adjustment period. But, you know, hopefully you come back and you share your art with us more and more. This is Mirror Stage's first show, a live produced show, fully produced in over a decade, which is amazing. How does that feel?
It feels great. I think her last production was my friend Rob Kuhn's play, Odin's Horse. So it's kind of fun to be following him up. He's also a Chicago person. But yeah, you know, Suzanne and I have been talking for 20 years, at least. She's been doing readings of my plays and, you know, she's done a bunch of readings with Mirror Stage. So to finally have this happen, and it was also supposed to happen during the pandemic. It was actually supposed to be a different play, and then that got postponed. And then all of a sudden, this play was more relevant. The squirrel plays were more relevant. So it's been a lot of changes as we go, but it's been good.
So the squirrel plays are sort of dark comedies, metaphors. And I noticed the first two ones, Infestation and Compensation. Infestation, just to get my facts straight and for the listener at home, was originally called The Play About the Squirrel.
Yes.
And then it's since been made into three plays about squirrels, hence the title of the series. But they're metaphors about the discussion around abortion for the first two. And then the third one is about race.
Yeah, well, the third one is about gun control and police brutality. And I mean, there's still a little bit of the reproductive rights issue going on in there as well. I initially titled the play, The Play About the Squirrel, because I wanted it to be a nod to Edward Albee's The Play About the Baby. And I thought it would at least tip like theater people off to the fact that it was actually a play about a baby or a fetus. And it didn't really. And so now the play is called Infestation, the first one. And yeah, so it's mostly about a couple who has a squirrel trapped in their attic. It's a metaphor for an unwanted pregnancy, and they have to get the exterminator in there and deal with the issue. And it really sort of creates a schism in their relationship, even though neither of them wanted squirrels. They had agreed. It's in the prenup. Yeah. No squirrels. So they are on rocky ground at the beginning of the second play. They get the bill for the extermination. And it's a lot. And the woman just wants it to be over. She's like, I thought you paid this already. Can we just have it be done? And the man is like, this is kind of crazy. I don't think we should have to pay this. Like, people shouldn't have to pay this. What if we couldn't afford it? And I wrote Compensation when the Affordable Care Act was being debated on the floor of Congress. And so this issue of paying for abortions, and were American taxes going to pay for abortion? And that question was coming up. And so that's where I was like, oh, well, maybe I'll bring in the Homeowners Association and they'll have a debate about it and have a vote and all of that. So I wrote that play during then, and race is introduced into that play. We find out that a couple of the members of the board, the Neighborhood Association board, are pretty racist. And then in the third play, I don't want to give it away, but there is an incident of a hate crime in the association. And then everything kind of shifts over towards what was inspired at the time by the Black Lives Matter movement and things like that. So,
and it's a comedy.
I mean, it's a comedy because it's about squirrels on the surface, right? And so it allows you, because it's absurd, like nobody cares this much about squirrels. You know, nobody is that devastated by having an extermination, you know, so it creates this sort of discomfort and schism, but it also allows me to talk about these subjects that we're so uncomfortable with, like abortion, like Black Lives Matter, like gun control.
And sort of the middle American suburbia of it all is this interesting microcosm of, I grew up in a small town. I sat through a lot of weird board meetings in my early days as a journalist, and people get really worked up over, I've seen people flip chairs over whether or not people should be allowed to smoke in a courtyard. You know, it does get to that absurd point, but it also creates this really interesting, very high pressure realm. The setting of your play, the high pressure and low stakes, that's part of the absurdity, I suppose, is people take these little things so seriously when it's all they have to latch on to.
Yes. What, for sure. What, why and in reality, it's such a big issue. It's such a like weighty issue, especially like the paying for the abortion and then the gun control. So putting it in this context, it is weird. You know, the third play, the first two plays show up in the first act, and then there's an intermission in the last play, which really does sort of take a left turn as far as the metaphor goes, is the third act. And I'll be interested to see how audiences respond to it.
Absolutely. And when you started writing Eradication, did you plan on it still being a squirrel play? Or did you start with it being something else?
No, I did. It was a squirrel play. When race popped up into the second play, so there's conversation about black squirrels showing up in the neighborhood. And the couple of people in the Homeowners Association are really upset about black squirrels infiltrating their neighborhood. And some people, when there were just the two plays, because for a while there were just the two, and like that's what was performed at the Edinburgh Fringe Fest, mm-hmm. you know, so people were like, well, why is race in there? And I'm like, well, race is always there, you know, whether or not you're mm-hmm. acknowledging it or not is another issue, but it's always there. And I also said, you know, I think there's a third play and I just don't know what it is yet. Mm-hmm. And then after Michael Brown and Sandra Bland and Lando Castile, I was like, I think this is the third play. I think this is why the Black Squirrel showed up in the play. And now I need to talk about Black Lives Matter and gun control and police brutality. So I knew it was going to be about the squirrels right away. And I knew that the metaphor was kind of taking a little bit of a left turn. And I was like, well, I'm just going to have to trust the audience to go with me. And there was also sort of an issue of the third play is about so many things. You know, the first two plays are pretty steadily about mm-hmm. abortion and paying for abortion. And the third play is about so many issues. And I'm like, well, hasn't that been like the last 10 years of our lives in America where all of a sudden all of these issues, I mean, I don't go into climate change. I don't go into like trans rights. I mean, mm-hmm. there's a lot of issues that could be in there that are not in there. But I feel like there was so much coming at us during the Trump presidency, with all the mass shootings we've been going through, with all the police brutality that we've been dealing with, that it's like, well, it's all here and we are all inundated by it all the time.
It's again, the absurdity and the overwhelm of the situation, right?
Mm-hmm.
That is a really fascinating shift. Do you think that that will affect your work going forward? Are you going to try to focus on the intersectionality of it all? Or are you thinking that maybe this was a lot
know.
On one chunk?
It was a new style for me. Like mm-hmm. I had not done this sort of heightened realism, absurdism before in my plays. And then after I wrote the play about the squirrel or infestation, I wrote a play called Lucinda's Bed, which is in a similar realm as far as style.
Mm-hmm.
It has a very similar tone, but is not sociopolitical at all. So, I mean, I think the big shift for me with the squirrel plays was just writing in a different, sparser way. But as far as juggling all the issues, I've done that for a long time, mm-hmm. I would say. Like the play that Suzanne was initially going to produce, Chagrin Falls, is more than anything about, well, it's about a small town where the two major industries are a prison where the death penalty is carried out and slaughterhouses where cows are killed. And so basically everybody there is making money off of death in one way or another. And it's more about the toll that takes on the community. And one of the characters is a Vietnam vet. And so there's that aspect of killing as well. And there's some conversation about vegetarianism and things like that. So there's a lot of angles going on in that piece. And I would say, yeah, I've been dealing with like the intersectionality of a bunch of issues for a long time in my pieces.
Okay. Well, we are just about up on our time here.
Okay.
Where can people find you online?
Oh, my website is miamacullough.com. My web series is thehavenweb.com. And I've written a book on the creative writing process, and there are links to that on my website. If you're a theater person and you have a subscription to the New Play Exchange, I'm also on there.
Fantastic. All that and more will be in our show notes. You can check them out right under this episode if you're on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Mia, thank you so much for joining us. Do you have any final thoughts that you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Just that it's an amazing cast. They're doing such a fantastic job. And yeah, the piece is at the 12th Avenue Arts Center, and folks should go and support them.
And that's, again, The Squirrel Plays. All right. Thank you. Thank you again so much for being here.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
And we're back. Thank you again to Mia McCullough for being on the show. I apologize for my shitty internet connection during our interview. Lindsay, what are we talking about? What's going on?
Well, I would love to talk about gender envy. We could just talk for a second because I know you'd love to have them as a guest on the podcast in the future.
Yeah, let's talk about gender envy. You brought them up during our discussion of Trans Day of Visibility as well.
Yeah, that was kind of where I first discovered them. They're this really cool band of students, 20-somethings, that met at UW, and they're all queer, trans, and they're just very affirming for younger queer and trans people to see just out in the world performing. They're just super fun to talk to. I got to hear all about some of their musical inspirations, everything from Paramore to Alice in Chains to BTS. Apparently, they just like pregame to BTS before all their performances. I think that's pretty funny. But yeah, they just have like great energy, great vibes. And if anybody's interested in checking them out, they're on Instagram at GenderNV69, where they post about their upcoming gigs that they do. Mostly they perform house shows and in bars, which they think is kind of ironic because they have a pretty young fan base of, you know, high school, college kids. So most of their fan base can't actually come out when they're performing at bars. So if you're somebody over 21 and you want to see kind of the next big thing in the punk scene in Seattle, come check them out. In the article, they talk a lot about what it means to be punk and why being queer and trans automatically kind of makes them punk, aside from even their vibes, which are super punk.
Fantastic. Speaking of queer art, the Met Gala, which has been touted as maybe one of the most pointless things ever to come out of Hollywood, was also really beautiful this year. You want to talk about that? I feel like you want to talk about that.
I absolutely want to talk about that. First of all, Lil Nas X, I don't know how he topped his like three outfit changes from last year, but I think he did because this year he came in just like a thong and head to toe, glitter, sparkles. He slayed. He was amazing. And there's a lot of other queer celebrities, as you were mentioning, Guillermo from What We Do in the Shadows. I absolutely loved the tweed look. He kind of gave me Queen of England vibes, but I was here for it.
Yeah, Harvey Guyan really, really sold that. Like, it wasn't quite a dress. It was sort of a suit, but it had like roses all over it. It was pink. It was gorgeous. Yeah, that's all I care about, really, in terms of the Met Gala. That outfit was beautiful.
I liked Bella Ramsey's outfit as well. They were just looking like a little sir, and I thought that was so good. There were so many great bow ties that everybody had, kind of the long bow tie look. But really, the men this year, they slayed. Usually, the men are just arm candy. They just come in like a plain suit, and everybody's always like, the Met Gala is for the femme people. But this year there was like so many people that took it up a notch. There were like textures and colors and hairdos that were just amazing. Except for Jared Leto. His outfit freaked me out.
I don't know what it was, nor do I care. Do you ever feel like there's this part of me that's like, okay, well, it's great that there's gender expression or non-traditional gender expression happening on these huge stages, these massive like celebrity stages that reach people of all walks of life, you know, through culture, right? I think if we're going to talk about good or doing good with the Met Gala, that's part of what it does, is it normalizes things or goes above and beyond to the point of absurdity where people are like, okay, maybe guys can wear dresses now. It exposes people who maybe otherwise wouldn't be exposed to that to, you know, non-gender conforming ideas. And that's what this whole gala really seemed to do in a big way. It's what everyone was talking about in the A&E news world, right?
Definitely.
However, it also really feels like the Hunger Games.
Oh my God. I messaged my sister because she kept posting pictures of celebrities. And I was like, this is just giving Hunger Games capital.
That's all it feels like, because these people make so much money for doing. It's not that it's not hard work, but it's also not something that necessarily makes a huge difference outside of its own sphere,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, art is subjective, and art is important, and art can have political meaning behind it. But I feel like most of these celebrities that go to the Met Gala and show up are not doing art for art's sake anymore. You know, it feels like they're just very wealthy people with a lot of money to spend on really weird outfits that are beautiful, well, gorgeous, and artistic. But I don't see how it's pushing the boundary of the good of the human spirit through art. It's just like, oh, this is sponsored by Chanel and it's pretty, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I can see the like just almost grotesqueness in the flaunting of wealth and resources at the Met Gala.
It hurts to watch.
It does. Yeah, especially with things like inflation and just like all of the human suffering that we know is going on. And it's like, it really brings about this conversation about performative activism, I think, mm-hmm. because a lot of the celebrities that do go to the Met Gala are activists. They donate, you know, millions of dollars to organizations and causes that they care about. But then at the end of the day, they're also wasting millions of dollars on, you know, a glitter bodysuit or Doja Cat coming looks like an actual cat, you know, with like just hours of hair and makeup and stylist. And it's like, what is this for aside from their egos?
Right.
Yeah, I get it. Me and my partner had a conversation about this, actually, because we were like, you know, at what point do we critique this? And at what point do we just like are stunned by it and amazed by it? And Isabel theory on the Met Gala is that everybody who is famous and has earned maybe this recognition deserves to go once. But then once you've done your round of being at the Met Gala and being around all of that craziness and wearing the outfit, anything after that is excess. You know, you've been there, you've done that. Save the money and give it to somebody who needs it.
Are you familiar with Rococo?
No.
French Rococo was an architectural and art style that was very popular among the incredibly wealthy, especially like princes and nobility, right before the French Revolution.
Oh, like the big hair?
Well, the big hair is part of the fashion, I guess, but I'm thinking about like those gilded, very ostentatious, beautiful couches that have the fleur-de-lis.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
I love that style aesthetically. It's also a lot easier to get now when you can 3D print, you know, something that looks like that. But back in the day, like a couple hundred years ago, it was an incredibly expensive, artist-crafted, handmade, like using fine minerals and like expensive silks. And meanwhile, people were dying because they couldn't eat.
The let them eat cake thing.
Right. It's like, well, if they can't afford bread, let them eat cake. And it's that whole disconnect between what's going on with the stars and what's happening with the writer's strike in Hollywood. Like the feeling of this ostentatious presentation, and it's like good for them, whatever. Like they made a lot of money doing something that they hopefully love. But then it's like the people that they're stepping on aren't seeing any of that money.
I think one of the most interesting juxtapositions between the writer's strike, which is going on right now, and the gala is Quinta Brunson. She's the creator, head writer, and star of Abbott Elementary. She went to the Met Gala for the first time this year, and she's actually started as like a BuzzFeed writer and is now attending the Met Gala, like has this hit show, won an Emmy. And she was at the Met Gala on Monday with like this most exquisite hairdo, like beautiful outfit. And then 2 days later, she was on the picket lines striking because she is also a writer. And so it's interesting to see the people that wear multiple hats as well, because so many of these writers aren't well known. And then you've got this person over here that has kind of the star power and privilege of the people in front of the camera, but is also putting in the work behind the camera. And I think that that's really important. And honestly, I feel like a lot of the celebrities that we idolize maybe don't deserve it as much as somebody like Quinta Brunson, who puts in that work behind the scenes as well.
Yeah, I agree. It's one thing to be a face, but it's another thing to actually have the thought and idea behind it and then execute it. Of course, I would say that as an editor-in-chief of an independent newspaper. I respect work when it's there, I guess. Like, you can't knock the hustle is something that I say a lot, even when people are fucking me over actively, I guess. I respect people who work, and I think people should benefit from the fruits of that labor. It doesn't make sense to live in a world where these faceless corporations and politicians and whoever profit off of what we, the working class, who are struggling to get by, do.
Yeah. When the stars of the show are at the Met Gala and then the writers can't afford their studio apartments in LA.
Right. I did see something about Abbott Elementary. It was like an article about how the season 2 finale of Abbott Elementary was maybe one of the best things on television this past season. And it was just lauded with praise and it was streamed all over the place and it was seen by a lot of people. But like the writer, like the head writer on that project, isn't going to see any of that money or any of that recognition.
Absolutely. That's kind of the whole controversy with the writer's strike right now, is the fact that streaming has opened up this platform for shows to reach so many more people than they used to when they would just air on television. And writers used to be paid, you know, thousands of dollars per air and then thousands of dollars per re-air on television. And that was how they made their money. And they're still being paid this much, but they are making very minimal amounts of money per like streaming view. And so when a majority of Americans today, like I don't pay for cable. I watched Abbott Elementary's season 2 and I watched it all on Hulu. And so by watching it all on Hulu, the writers aren't seeing nearly as much from the way that shows are being consumed now than had I like, you know, paid for cable and watched it on ABC. So that's kind of why they're striking, is they want to be seeing the profits that the corporations are making, because Disney and Fox and, you know, it's really just these two big corporations that own everything. And Disney and Fox are the same. But like Disney and NBC, they're making millions and millions of dollars off of all of the streaming services that they're investing in now and that people are paying for. But it's really just fucking over the writers and, you know, the little people behind the scenes.
There's a similar thing that's been going on for a while with musicians and streaming music on Apple Music or streaming music on Spotify, right?
Yeah.
Like, I still do it. I stream everything. It's what I can afford to do.
Yeah.
You know, it's like it's $12 a month versus like a cable bill of hundreds of dollars or whatever, or like buying new records all the time, which I still do buy new records, but it's once in a...
It's for the aesthetic too, the records.
Well, the reason I like vinyl is A, it sounds really good. B, I have a great record player that looks rad as hell. And C, I don't always need my data tracked as when I'm listening to like a sad song, right? I don't always need all of my information out there in the world being sold by other people. But also, I grew up in a household with vinyl, which was weird, I guess, in the 90s. But like, I had a record player in high school and I inherited my dad's old records, which honestly weren't all that good. But there's a nostalgia element. Mm-hmm. For me as well, and for a lot of millennials, I think there is that. It's like it's a way for me to get away from my screen. It's not 100% aesthetic, but it's like I'm not going to be tweeting about, oh, my vinyl collection, you know. I'm going to be enjoying the music as it is. Just like with live music, I try not to post. But that being said, I stream all the time because it's just easier.
Well, it's affordable for the consumer.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
I don't know if it's just the fact that this strike is happening days after the Met Gala, but... You know, what you brought up about the French Revolution, I feel like we're in the modern French Revolution in a way. I mean, we haven't started chopping heads off yet, but...
I've felt this way for a long time. You know, I've been on both sides of the economic spectrum. When I was a kid, we had a fair amount of cash. My relatives still do have a fair amount of money. In between 2008 and 2012, we lost our home. And then my folks have both been trying very hard to get back up to that, like, upper middle class echelon, right? Where they're comfortable saying, oh, we're well off, we're comfortable, which is such a rich person thing to say. But I've been on my own since 2013, and I couldn't afford to go to college, and I couldn't afford to eat for several weeks at a time. And I've been working multiple jobs for over a decade now. And I was on the workforce before I even moved out of my parents' house, just because I needed to try to like build up revenue to get by, right? So from my perspective, the revolution has been coming for a long time because I've seen how both sides live. I've lived both ways. And it's not, I guess, as black and white as that, but it's interesting being in Seattle and knowing that I make more money than I would be if I lived in my small hometown, but that I still can't afford to live. And I think that that is the basis of all workers' strikes everywhere and all unions everywhere. And the opposition to that is sometimes those small businesses or small newspapers like ours, we can't always afford to pay people what they deserve. I believe in the cause we have here. And so I'm fighting for our paper every week. But I stand with the writer's strike. And if you can get that money that you are owed, you should get it. Profit, I think, is inherently immoral.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I'm also looking at it from the standpoint of, I wonder how long this writer's strike is going to go on, you know, because unlike other strikes that we've seen and even talked about on the show, like the railroad union strike or Starbucks strike, well, maybe not Starbucks, maybe it's akin to Starbucks. This is entertainment, and entertainment is not a necessity to keep our economy going, to keep people alive. Also, entertainment is traditionally a very difficult business to get into, and people are willing to sell their souls. I wonder if they would, you know, fire the writers involved in the strikes and bring on new blood to, you know, keep it going. How dedicated are these people going to be to the cause? Are we going to see, like, when fall TV comes back, will they just not have any new shows because the writers aren't writing?
Well, part of it is also, like, in response to ChatGPT and AI writers spouting up. I mean, new technology is scary. Maybe they should limit certain amounts of that if they want to keep the human element to media. Respectfully, I think I have to disagree with you. I think media is incredibly important to the workings of our nation. And there's a more cynical side to that, I think. But people need to have their souls nourished. They have to have entertainment. And they have to sort of experience things and learn about things through play. I think that play is very important to the human spirit and to the mind in general, because when you're all work and no play, when you're getting things shoved down your throat, what happens is you become like the generations before us, where all you care about is consumption, right? And all you care about is working all the time. And then that creates a toxic work environment forever. We don't put artists on the same level as like other working class jobs because they're not down there in the mines or whatever.
Yeah.
But they are important, you know, in a different way. I think we look at it as like, are they productive? People need to have those jobs to yada yada. But this is the cynical part of this. America is influential in the rest of the world, not just because of our military, but because all of the media that comes out of us goes everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It's why British actors can do American accents and why people know so much about American culture. It's the culture we put out into the world, right?
Yeah.
And even more cynical, I guess, we could say that if the writers that are putting out good work are not getting paid for what they're doing, who is going to step in and produce writers for us? Who controls the narrative? Like Marvel movies have to run all their scripts by the U.S. military so that it doesn't make them look bad, right?
Yeah.
Where that could lead is if all of these corporations are putting out content that is just done by scabs, what does that mean for the moral future and the kids that are consuming that art later on down the line? Because it does have an impact.
Yeah. I mean, I think we also need to look at art. And I mean, here, if we're looking at the writers of Hollywood, television and movies, but television as a good. And when you look at the market of goods, when you have a surplus, the cost and the demand for it, you know, goes down. And what streaming has really done is provide a surplus, because now you can watch the entirety of any sitcom that has aired anytime ever at your fingertips in ways that, you know, in the early 2000s, you watched what was on as it aired. You know, Friday night, if the new episode of Friends was on, that's when you watched it. Now you can watch every single episode of Friends. And for these new generations as well, people like my age and younger that didn't grow up with that experience, we have literally years of television that we can just consume and watch and be just as enamored with as audiences were 20 years ago. So it also brings kind of the question of demand back, because yes, we demand newness and new shows and new plots, but at the same time, they can just push us to watch the sitcoms and the series that maybe we didn't grow up with that are still good, were still written well, and then those writers aren't going to be paid for that. So yeah, I just wonder about the market and how it's going to be affected.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe art should just be made for art's sake. Maybe everything we do as a society should just be done because we want to do it and not because overlords tell us, hey, you owe us tax or you owe us rent. Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah.
And I guess this experience running this paper, right, has proven to me that even if I'm not making ends meet, I still want to do something like this, you know, because I think it's good. I would hope that the rest of the world would, if given the opportunity, find their bliss and work towards a community where we are doing things that we love.
Yeah.
Anyway, watch Beef on Netflix.
Absolutely. And you need to watch it so we can discuss it after you finish it, because you're going to be obsessed with it.
I will do that. Folks, that's our show. Thank you so much for sticking with us for this conversation about creativity. You can find us online at Seattle Gay News on Instagram and Twitter. You can find Radio SGN's personal account, or I guess, you know, our podcast-only account if you like goofy memes and stuff, at radio.sgn. You can follow us on Facebook. Yes, that is still a thing. Did they steal our data? Absolutely. However, we're still on Facebook. We're on Twitter, sort of, and you can check us out online at www.sgn.org. If you're already listening to us on that website, that's great. Tell your friends, give us a 5-star review on Spotify or a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, because that helps us find new listeners. And don't you want to have something to stream for free that you can talk about with your friends?
Yeah, this entertainment is coming to you.
Almost for free.
Yeah.
With that said, we do accept donations to the SGN, and we've got an exciting project coming up that you're going to hear all about in June. But if you want to go to sgn.org and press that little donate link, go ahead and donate to the GoFundMe that they set up when George passed, who used to run the whole kit and caboodle, or you can donate directly to our publisher's PayPal or Venmo, because that will keep us alive operating. Lindsay, is there anything you'd like to add?
No, I don't think so. Just pet your dog and have a great week.
Pet your dog. Have a great week. Oh, I have a snail update.
Oh, yes.
Real quick snail update for all of you Rebus fans out there. Unfortunately, a couple months ago, Rebus did die. It was fully grown when I got him, which is about, they usually live about 2 years, but I got him about 3 years ago, so he lived about 5 years. And I did write a short story kind of commemorating this snail by turning his shell into a dark fantasy abandoned druid city, but you can read that when it gets published. It'll be on air on a different podcast later. But I also got a new snail that was just hatched.
Mm.
And their name is Riddle. And they're getting so big, you guys, in their little moss terrarium. So, you know, sometimes tragedy strikes and there are new beginnings. And this snail is a common garden snail. And so they do, if I take good enough care of them, they can live from 10 to 20 years.
Oh, wow.
Like a cat. Yeah. So we'll see how that goes.
That's amazing. We'll have to post a picture.
Absolutely. Thank you guys so much for listening. And I will see you in the funny pages.
Radio SGN is hosted by A.V. Eichenbaum and Lindsay Anderson, and produced by A.V. Eichenbaum. Music for this show was provided by T.R.G. Banks and Jesse Spillane, or was provided for free by Anchor. Thank you so much for listening. Check us out on sgn.org or wherever you find podcasts. This podcast is part of the Seattle Gay News Podcasting Network.